Hi, this is Phil Lairness, sitting alongside my wife, Lily Lairness. As we travel through the third decade of the 21st century, it's good to know that the Midweek Drive and Midweek Drive Morning Editions continue to produce a minimum of 4 hours of weekly audio goodness on Siren Radio and southsidebroadcasting.podbean.com. Why do you have that glazed expression on your face, Lil?
Too many numbers in that announcement.
It's almost the A-team of Midweek Drive connections, because from Acton, London, we have our BAFTA award-winning director, Graham Harper. How are you, Graham?
I'm very well, thank you. Hi, everyone.
From Wales, the northern part, that is, we have the fine Welsh film critic that is Robin Pierce. How are you, Robin?
Hello there.
And, of course, from Los Angeles, California, now unlocked and in full glorious Technicolor, the author of the fabulous Illyria, and, yes, the second book in the series is coming out shortly, Armin Shimmerman. Welcome, Armin.
Thank you. Thank you. Nice to be here.
Excellent. Hello, Armin.
Hello. How are you, Graham?
Very well, thank you. Yeah, nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
Here we are with, as I say, the eve of Illyria being one of our Southside Broadcasting's books of the month, which we're going to be disseminating, as I say, on another program, curiously entitled Book of the Month. Shepherds, Armin, how is life in Los Angeles now? Is it all back to normal, or is it just a case of, no, California, it's never going to be back to normal?
I'm embarrassed to say and happy to say that we're doing much better than England. As of Tuesday, our governor opened up pretty much everything here, as did the governor of New York. So I wouldn't say everything is back to normal, but things are very much close to being back to normal. When we go into stores, we still have to wear masks. I believe at this point we have 68% or perhaps 72% of the population of California vaccinated, at least with one vaccination. And when we get to 70, they tell us that's the optimum place to be. We'd like to get to 100, of course, but that will depend on the people pretty much in the southern states.
Doesn't it always? I mean, you can go back to 1861, 1865. It depended on the southern states then as well. But anyway,
it does depend on the southern states.
Graham, anything you'd like to put to Armin at this moment in time and space?
Yes, I saw that you did a film called The Fifth Passenger. I'd love to know more about it and what your character is.
Well, it's a small budget picture that was done by some lovely people. And I jumped at the chance not only to work with them, but it is perhaps the only time I've ever played a character who was decent. he was a rather decent fellow, and he gets killed. I'm giving this away, but gets killed sort of midway in the movie. But he's kind. He's considerate. He's a lovely, lovely gentleman. What's it about? It's a sci-fi picture, and should keep you hanging on the edge of your seat. I was very happy to see the final cut, and I recommend to everyone that they get a chance to see it. It doesn't appear in very small. In a large number of markets, because it is a small picture, and it's finding, I believe it's on, you know, I can't even tell you where it's on, but it is, as more people see it, it is getting more and more markets.
Oh, we'll look it out. We'll go online and check it out.
Thank you, Graham. Thank you.
We'll start the promotion factor this very day with indeed our film critic.
I should also point out that Marina Sirtis is in it. And I believe there are one or two other Star Trek alumni there as well. It was just a delight to do.
It's not a spin-off. It's completely different characters.
Yes, totally different characters. Right. And we are not playing the characters we did on Star Trek. But in fact, Marina, I would venture to say, is also playing a character very far from her Star Trek character. Mm.
She's not playing a Tottenham Hotspur supporting solo, is she, Armin? Because I know she has a fondness for Tottenham Hotspur. We've had difficulties with that, but there we are.
Yeah, she spent a lot of time on the streets before she came to the United States. So there's that factor that exists in her as well.
Yeah, it's live. Anyway, speaking of Illyria, which we were, and before we actually turn to Robin, I was fascinated in one little aspect that you referred to. Obviously, one of the lead characters, of course, in Illyria, John Dee, if not the lead character apart from Shakespeare, and of course, John Dee's connection with magic. So we thought, I mean, for this particular routine, we'd bring on board your very own magician from Scotland, specifically David Fox. How are you, David?
Hello, David.
Hello, Alice. Hello, Armin. Lovely to see you both today. And how are you both keeping? Are you both well?
I'll speak first and say yes. I've been very fortunate. I've seemed to have missed the pandemic. Basically, writing these books has kept me inside, so I haven't been exposed much. But yes, I am very well.
Glad to hear, Martin.
Very.
It's always great to see Alex. Yeah. Good to see you both.
Well, you may say that, David, but let's face it, in a few hours from now, with the England-Scotland game taking place, who knows what could actually happen on that basis.
Don't talk about that.
Probably another glorious failure for one or other of the sides. Armin, yeah. On to John Dee. Was it fair to say that in the Elizabethan era, because you have studied this extensively, that the difference between science and magic was pretty indivisible? I mean, it's the same with astrology and astronomy, really.
Lovely way of putting that, Alex. Absolutely. It was indivisible. Many people thought magic was science or the science was magic. There was a slight distinction, of course, but there wasn't the division that we have today. People went to astrologers, to magicians, to consult about their physical problems, their mental problems, and science, a lot of science, excuse me, came out of, I've just forgotten the word, alchemy.
The ether.
From alchemy. And so the alchemy is a strange combination of both science and magic.
And again, that search for the Philosopher's Stone, it's not just Harry Potter who's interested in it, the whole essence of finding that.
Queen Elizabeth was interested in the Philosopher's Stone, as was her chief secretary, Cecil, Lord Burleigh, who was hoping to get that so that he could pay for ships, protection. The Philosopher's Stone would have brought him a great deal of money, and he spent a lot of money looking for people who could perhaps bring that to him.
All about transmutation, David. Clearly, in your own history of magic, that could occur in so many ways. Any thoughts that you'd like to add in terms of your own studies of magic? And indeed, maybe you'll demonstrate one or two things for us in this very Zoomer.
Well, I tell you, I had a little bit of a moment there. The internet went down, so I had to use some magic to get it to come back on again. So I was getting, but no, back to what Armin was saying, John Dee is a fascinating character. And of course, him and Edward Kelly, I have studied John Dee. I am reading a biography on Aleister Crowley at the moment by John Simmons. And he talks about John Dee's magic and about Kelly, who Dee traveled with. But what was it that got you interested in magic, Armin? Have you always been interested in this area? Is this something that's always fascinated you?
I won't say that I'm interested in magic. I am interested in John Dee. Because of John Dee, I certainly have rubbed shoulders with magic. I'm interested in John Dee because of who he was, and for the fact that for centuries he was relegated to the bottom of the historical pit because of his ardent desire to want to talk to angels. But what history has found in the last 75 years is that all the scientific things that he accomplished, all the mathematical things that he accomplished, were great accomplishments, and that we should take a second look at him. And so I took a second look at him and became fascinated with the gentleman. Several years ago, about 2 or 3 years ago, I got off the plane in Heathrow, and instead of taking a cab into London, I said to the cabbie, can you take me to Mortlake and have a little pilgrimage to John Dee's house? I think one wall exists of the house by the Thames. However, there's a housing project a block away that says the Dee apartment. So,
right, yeah, fascinating, yeah. And of course, the predictions he made about the Armada, and his scrying, the implements he used to scry are on display at the British Museum.
Yes, I've seen them. Thank you, David.
I didn't see them.
I think we both recommend to everyone that if they go to the British Museum, they should take a look at the scrying implements, the wax tablets, and the other things. He also was he picked absolutely the right date for Elizabeth to become queen, and she thanked him all her life. She never gave him much money, but she always thanked him for picking that inauguration date.
Yes.
Just goes to show the magic of John Dee. Or could he have actually been an Elizabethan Nikola Tesla? I don't know. It's another thought entirely.
I think he wanted to be. Perhaps he didn't get there, but he certainly wanted to be. And he was consulted many times by very important people about scientific, astrological, medicinal things.
Well, speaking of which, when we speak about medicinal things and aspects relating to the joy and wonderment of Armin Schumann, I know that our Welsh correspondent will be bursting if we didn't give him the chance to actually throw a couple of questions related to Not Far Beyond the Stars, but obviously the Deep Space Nine series. Robin, the floor is now yours. Away you go, sir.
Thank you. Armin, this is your moment of truth. This is Robin. Where you realize that Alex has locked you in with yet another rabid Trekkie. There's always one, right?
You're speaking to one right now, Robin. Go ahead.
I've been watching Deep Space Nine. I've been doing a rerun of Deep Space Nine on DVD. And it strikes me that although I was a little bit tepid about it when it was first shown, it has aged so, so well. And in fact, it's an ageless show. And it plays better as the years have gone by. I've always thought of it as Casablanca in space. But when I've been watching it now, I've realized that although that still holds true, it's not quite the way I thought it was, because in my most recent reviewing, I realized that Sisko is not Rick at all. It's Quark.
Yes, Quark
actually runs Deep Space Nine, because nothing happens on that station that he doesn't know about or has a finger in to profit or an eye. Even in scenes where you have little to no dialogue, where you're just in the background, you act through that prosthesis so well that every time I'm looking at you, I'm thinking, he's up to something. He's looking for the angle. So my heartiest congratulations on that.
Thank you.
What really, in a cast, an ensemble cast, actually, that consists of, you know, so many human characters, and the prevailing makeup of the day was freckling at the sides or a ridged nose. You and René Auberjonois had the most outlandish makeups and prosthetics on your face. And yet, it's the interplay between you two that actually makes the thing crackle to life. Because even in The Emissary, when everybody else is introducing each other to each other, you know, I get the feeling that you and Odo, Quark and Odo, I apologize, have been doing this for a very long time. And you used to do rehearsals on a Sunday with some of the other alien actors. I was wondering, how long did it take you and Mr. Auberjonois to get to that level of your characters? And was he ever a part of those rehearsals? I mean, how much work did you have to do to work through that level of prosthetics? I'm sorry, this is really long-winded, but hey.
I will try to answer your question as best I can. First, let me correct your pronunciation. It's Auberjonois. So there's that. Two, René and I had worked together in a play, A Petrified Forest, several years before. So we had met before. We didn't really interact that much while we were doing the play. My scenes and his scenes were never on the same scene together. So, but we did have that relationship. Further, Robin, because we both came from the theater and because we had a ton of friends that we had in common, it made it easier for us to form that relationship. The other thing that helped immensely was that because we had the makeup, and because it took me 2 hours, it took him a little less than an hour to get into makeup, we spent a lot of time sitting right next to each other. So I was as close to him as perhaps I am to you right now, if that's possible. And And so we spoke a lot. And our mutual friends and our common history bound us together. So yes, that helped. Yes, in the beginning, Renee and I spent a lot of time on Sundays working out our scenes because we were theater actors. We were used to rehearsal. We were comfortable with, but didn't particularly like the idea that you had to come up with ideas for a scene in the 20 minutes or so while they're lighting it. And we wanted more rehearsal. So we took the advantage of rehearsing at my house. He didn't come to too many of the Ferengi rehearsals, except for the ones where he directed. When he directed a Ferengi episode, then he came for the Sunday rehearsals. But I think if you look at the original show, one of the things that made it crackle was the relationship between Bones and Spock. And I would venture to say that our relationship emulated that relationship. It was the love-hate relationship that we had that was emulated in the Spock-Bones relationship that helped make the program interesting to people. It was that dynamic that was one of the jewels of the crown.
And let's actually segue neatly from there to a who's actually outside today. But Armin, she is, of course, one of our fine book reviewers who'll be looking at Illyria, plug again, in terms of having a look throughout. Jessica, any questions you'd like to share with the team, Armin, David, Graham, or indeed Robin, from your external North Carolina base?
I would love to. I actually have a question for Armin on the topic of Quark. And when my mom actually heard your voice, she was outside for a second. She was like, oh, is it with the him? Put her hands up to make the ears.
I think I got hired because I was halfway there when I walked into the audition.
So I have a question. I was wondering, so I know a lot of actors will kind of make a backstory or some lore about their character that never really gets incorporated into the plot. And I was wondering, did you do that with Quark? And if you did, is there maybe some information you could share about him that we don't know?
I'm sorry to disappoint. I didn't create a backstory. I had a backstory sort of imposed on me because I had played Ferengi before on Next Generation. So I had a familiarity with the race that perhaps the other actors didn't have. But that's the extent of my backstory. I really took it from episode to episode. And I brought certain expectations about what I wanted to do with the character, which isn't necessarily backstory, but were expectations of what I wanted to do. I'm repeating myself. And in fact, Ira, the head writer after Michael Piller, recently has told me that there were certain things he came to understand that I would not do or that I could not do. And when he realized that, he would give the more farcical choices to Max, who played Rom, because Max was willing and capable of doing those rather absurd, again, farcical choices. I was a much more grounded Ferengi, and I wanted to be that. So if that's part of my backstory, yes.
And with your, I guess, I don't know if I should wait to ask this until the book review, but just out of curiosity, did you kind of have to go through a process of filling in information about the book characters? And
yes, well, I was very familiar with the characters in Twelfth Night. I was very familiar with the life of Shakespeare, but as David pointed out, I was not as familiar with John Dee, and I have spent what I would say 15 years, as long as you've been alive, studying John Dee and everything attached to John Dee. So I had to fill that in. But even as I was writing, whatever I knew, and I knew quite a bit, I had to go and research even more. And it doesn't stop, even though I've stopped writing the first book and have just sent in the polish for the second book, there isn't a day goes by that I don't do some investigation into either John Dee, William Shakespeare, or the period of the time. And it is very cheeky of me, by the way, to be looking at all you Brits. And I've written a novel about England and about two British characters. And I understand it's very cheeky of me, but, you know, that's the way it goes.
I mean, let's break this down. Jessica obviously is based in North Carolina, so she's keeping up the American end. David is
Welsh.
Scottish.
I understand you're not all English. Yes, some of you are Welsh. I get that. And I understand the division
and
very
Scottish.
Well. And Scottish, exactly. Right. And I believe Scotland is going to have another referendum soon to find out if they're going to stay or not. So
I've no doubt it will be the Republic of Scotland, and they'll actually appoint Phil Leonis as a director of all things to actually be overseeing the whole thing. Phil Leonis, welcome to the Midweek Drive. You complete the Magnificent Seven, which is fantastic. And we've just been sharing some thoughts on Armin's work with Illyria, a text which is so filmic, it's just unbelievable. I'll say that now, even before the book review. So how are you, Phil?
Who can answer that question off the top of their head? I'm late, but then again, I'm on the West Coast. We don't even know what time it is anymore. We don't know whether we're supposed to wear masks, not wear masks. I mean, I don't know anything anymore. So,
however, Phil, it's fair to say that your wonderful wife, Lily Holliman, has indeed worked with Armin. Is that not so?
The actress Lily Holliman. I mean, my wonderful wife is Lily Lairness. I expect her to go by my name. But yes, Lily worked with Armin directly recently in a play reading, a spectacular play, but had also been in a cast, but not in the same piece on SciFest before, a one-act festival. And I've never had the good fortune to get to speak to Armin before. And I've had a question that I've been dying to ask him, if that's all right.
Well, Robin was bursting, and he's actually, I think it's fair to say, Robin, you're relieved now. Apart from the pronunciation of René Auberjonois, everything's okay. So that's good.
Phil. Oh, no. Did we already discuss René Auberjonois?
No, we didn't.
Up to a point. Oh, go for
because,
it, Phil.
Because I recently saw this wonderful film from Kelly Reichardt, A First Cow, which was the final screen performance for Mr. Auberjonois. And it reminded me, it evoked such wonderful memories of McCabe and Mrs. Miller from Robert Altman and...
Mash.
Yeah, his early work. And one of the things that I think would surprise so many people who know him from later work, even comedic later work like Boston Legal or before that, Benson, where he was often kind of the straight man, the foil, is just what an almost effortless, graceful, light comedic touch this man had. And everything that I saw from a distance was that reflected who he was behind the scenes, someone who was very easy with a smile and a laugh. And you had
times.
Well, this is what I wanted to ask. You had such great rapport with him on screen. I wondered if you could describe a little bit the rapport off screen and how that translated.
Well, yes, I'm happy to do that. And I want to echo one of the greatest people I ever met in my life was René. And it was always an honor to work with him. And a little bit intimidating because he was indeed so good. He had a louche quality, that's what you were just describing, because he came from an enormous artistic family. His grandfather, also René Auberjonois, hangs in the D'Orsay in Paris. He was a second-tier impressionist painter, but very good in his own right. So there's that. His father was an award-winning journalist, and lived in an artistic community in New York, where René grew up with a lot of other artists, including, oh my God, I've just forgotten his name. There was an American commercial, you remember, Because They Earned It. Who was that? That's
John Houseman?
John Houseman. And it's John Houseman, thank you, John Houseman, who started René's career. He recognized René's talent early on and took René with him and started his career in the theater. But René was a fascinating man. He was a brilliant photographer. He was a brilliant sculptor. I own at least three wire sculptures that René has done. And there's one I covet that I don't own that maybe one day I will acquire. He was a brilliant actor. He was a terrific director. And he was a very good friend. And he was a very hard worker. I have nothing but good things to say of him. He could at times, when something rubbed him the wrong way, erupt. And that happened more often than it does for me, let's say. But he was very good after erupting to let it all go and go back to where he was. He was an enormous team player as well, despite the fact that he always shines in an ensemble.
Yes.
He was always willing to be a team player.
Well, I'm curious about that. I mean, you do, here's a gentleman who you've just described, if I may use the words, Renaissance person. Here's a Renaissance person who is also a terrific ensemble team player, which is such an interesting combination of characteristics, really. So what is it that makes, without telling tales out of school, obviously, but what is the sort of thing that would make someone who is such a foundational team player erupt, as you describe? What's the thing that would rub him the wrong way?
When he felt his ego was being attacked, which makes all of us erupt. But when he felt that he was being dissed, or when he felt that things were when people were being refusing to listen to what he had to say, he would erupt, and it would be quite ugly. I was never the brunt of any of those, but I was present at a number of them. They were not pretty to look at, but as I said, he would erupt like Etna, and then he would calm down and he would go back to being the professional that he always was. I miss him greatly. There isn't a day goes by that he isn't part of a conversation that I'm having. I lived in his shadow, and I was enormously grateful for all the times, not only on Deep Space Nine, but all the times that we appeared together on stage and acted together. It was a little like, for me, acting with Olivier or anyone of that caliber, he was so far above me, and I had to move 10 times as fast to keep up with him.
There is actually one scene when I think of the two of you together, interestingly enough, much as I was a huge fan of Deep Space Nine, the scene that I always go to in my mind of the two of you is from Boston Legal. There's a scene where you play a judge in the chambers, and it's a masterclass, if I may say, of the back and forth between you.
Well, that's going back to the question, did we have a backstory? Well, of course we had a backstory in that scene. And in fact, when that scene was delivered to me, I called Renee up and said, Renee, this isn't Boston Legal, this scene. This is Quark and Odo. And he said, yeah, it's a joke. They're never going to do that. They're never going to shoot this scene. And of course we did shoot it. One of the, I think it was the sound man was, there was a desk in my office for that scene. And we had shot the master, and this gentleman was sitting between Renee and I, and he knew Renee much better than he knew me. And he turned to Renee and he said, you know, I just watched that scene that the two of you just did, and it looked like you'd been playing together for years. He had no knowledge of the fact that of our Deep Space background. And Renee and I exploded into laughter because, of course, we had been doing it for years. And that's what that was. It may be Boston Legal, but it's right out of Deep Space Nine.
It sure beats the alternative of the sound guy turning to you and saying, that wasn't bad for the first time working together.
Exactly.
The only thing that I take exception to is you're saying that we all get upset when our egos are under attack. Our gracious host, Alex Lefchuk, has no ego to bruise.
Phil, I will cite a Robin Pierce cartoon that you sent me in which it goes, ego and superego walk into the bar and the barman says, show some ID. It's a classic. It's a Friday thing. David, would you like to just, I hesitate to use the term throw in, but would you like to just do a quick little piece of magic for us whilst the whole team, the ensemble cast, is duly assembled?
please.
Well, of course, no, lovely to be here. And of course, I can see Armin and Alex, and I can see everybody else now. So please forgive me when I came on. I've managed to expand the screen here. I was getting a little bit stressed because I couldn't get on to the internet. So now I'm here. But I do have a deck of cards, as you would expect from a magician, ladies and gents. And the big card here on the table, we'll come back to that in a few moments' time. But I just need people to name playing cards. It's as simple as that. And maybe let's start with, well, it's the first time I've seen Phil. I always hear your voice when we talk on the radio. But what card would you like, Phil? Any card at all?
Oh, I'm selecting a card. I thought when you said name a card, I had to come up with a name, like James. Okay, so I select a card. I would like the Four of Hearts, please.
The Four of Hearts. Oh, a lovely choice, the Four of Hearts. I'll tell you a little story about the Four of Hearts, ladies and gents. I was very, very lucky to perform at Her Majesty's Jubilee celebration several years ago. Carol Vorderman went for the Four of Hearts. So it used to be known as Carol's card, but it will now be known as Phil's card from now on. So give Phil a big round of applause. Superb. Well
Let's
done.
Give David a round of applause.
But I tell you something, if I was in the audience, Armin, I'd be thinking, hang on a minute, maybe that's a fluke or maybe it's a setup. So let's ask the lovely Jessica to name a card. What card would you like, Jessica?
May I have the Seven of Clubs?
The Seven of Clubs. Now, is the Seven of Clubs a lucky card for you, Jessica?
It's my cousin's favorite number.
It definitely is a lucky card for me, or the Seven of Shamrocks, as I say to non-card players. Now, this could go on all day, ladies and gents, and I have been banned from several casinos, as you can imagine. The big card here, can you see the big card? It's the Queen of Hearts, okay? Now, we'll pop the Queen of Hearts over here on the table. And let's just see if Armin can provide the final little piece of magic. I'm going to riffle into the cards here, Armin, and just say stop whenever you're ready. Is that okay, sir?
Yes, sir. You're ready.
Let's go.
Stop.
Just around about the midpoint here. We'll twist there where Armin has stopped. A card is going to pop out of the pack. Can you see the card?
I can.
Ladies and gents, does the card match with the big card?
Not at this present moment, no.
Armin's got there before me. Oh. It's the king, the king of spades here, a magic card. Give Armin a big round of applause, ladies and gents.
That's great, David. That's
I think John Dee. I think John Dee had a hand in that one as well, Armin. So well done.
He might have, yes. Certainly Edward Kelly, absolutely.
Oh, he was a fascinating. In fact, I was reading about the Enochian magic. What's your take on the Enochian system? Have you read much into that?
I have indeed. For those who don't know, the Enochian system is John Dee's compilation of an angelic dictionary. In other words, the language that angels speak in, that's what he was always trying to do, was to speak to angels. And he compiled a dictionary, an Enochian dictionary of angelic words. So what's my take on that? I think, with all due respect, because I tend to be more pragmatic than anything else, I believe Mr. Kelly took Mr. D for a ride. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the kind of view John Simmons takes, because Victor Neuberg and Crowley went into the desert and experimented with that. And he's a bit, he takes a similar view. But it's very interesting. It's very, very interesting.
It's fascinating. And just to think of the amount of time and care, just as you have taken, David, with your magic, so must have Edward Kelly, as far as convincing this very knowledgeable man that he was indeed speaking to higher powers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's certainly been a wonderful, fascinating way of actually bringing technology to the fore, whether it's morning in California, obviously for Phil and Armin, whether it's afternoon for Jessica, whether it's a case of, well, it's actually, you're not in Scotland, are you, David? You're still in Nottingham. So
I'm in Nottingham, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Very hot and humid here today. How is it in your neck of the woods, Alex?
For Phil and I, it just rained, so it's a little bit humid here as well.
Rainier.
Well, there we are. And you realise that when we reach the start, the classic line of, oh, they're British people, they must be talking about the weather. That's great. We'll move on. Graham, we started off these shows back in the day, back in the 1980s. Now we have a Magnificent Seven. It falls to you as senior co-presenter, head boy, to throw the last two questions at the team in whichever order you wish, Graham. So off you go.
Oh, ladies and gentlemen, have you had a reasonably good time on this conversation?
Yes, excellent. I certainly have, but it's been a lot about me. So yes, absolutely.
We've enjoyed that. And will you come back again?
Over and over, over and over. I really enjoy the conversations. I love the camaraderie. Alex is a wonderful moderator. And everyone that you've brought on to for these panels, I've enjoyed immensely.
Well,
and we have too.
Happy to hear that, yeah. Because I just say he was bursting, but at least we got the whole thing through.
Yes, I was. And next time, I want to go all the way back to Pascal.
Yeah. Well,
one thing I have noticed this time, though, I'm sorry to go off topic, but I've been a bit distracted, to be honest with you, because where's Graham's scarf?
Ah, well, at the moment, it is, well, not at this moment, but it's very, very hot. And even I can't wear a scarf.
It's even sunny in Wales.
Ah, yes, it's wonderful. Oh, listen, wasn't that a marvellous match yesterday against Turkey? Wonderful, wonderful.
Don't ask Robin about the football, Graham. I mean, it's bad enough. Yeah, he's in the lead of the football predictor things. It's outrageous.
It was very nice.
Oh, best of the series so far.
I would just like to point out something that I don't know if Robin or Graham have had the opportunity to see. I know I haven't, but it's just lovely to see Jessica outdoors not locked in a cinder block dorm room where I feel like she spent the last 16 months.
Well, you missed out the other day, Graham, because she was modeling a pair of like 1980s glasses that are even bigger than mine that were a lot like Linda Carter's in Wonder Woman. It was something to see.
Trying out new fashion. Well, I see. Graham, did you get a haircut?
Yes.
It looks very nice.
Yeah.
Back
in the pre-Zoomer days, we could never actually ask our telephonic correspondents, did they get a haircut? Well, they could have asked, and they could have said anything, but it just goes to show.
Well, I would like to point out that of the men on this panel, Graham's pretty much the only one she could have asked that to.
Yes.
You're right about that, Phil. Yeah, absolutely. I have a question for Jessica as well. Jessica, how are things there in your state as far as masks and social distancing?
Become anarchy at this point. I don't know what's happening. Where it's people are just it's just a free for all. Some people are wearing masks, some aren't. There's going to be fights in like the middle of Chick-fil-A and Walmart or something. It's very weird right now with the mask rules. So I'm just trying to avoid South Carolina at this point. So.
And fights in Chick-fil-A and Walmart. Obviously, things are getting very serious, but never mind. Don't forget, Illyria is available online. You can access that, etc. And the sequel will be due in the very near future, which is fantastic. Number two in the awesome trilogy. For the moment, to Graham Harper, Robin Pierce, David Fox Magic, of course, Phil Learness, Jessica Burtis, and Armin Schumann, huge thanks. Keep on keeping on. Be well, be safe, and be happy.
Bye-bye, all. Thank you very much.
Bye.
Thank you.
Jessica Burtis flying the flag for North Carolina across the solar system.
Did you know that in 1991, a bill was passed by the North Carolina Senate changing the official proportions of the state flag from a length one-third more than its width to a length one-half more than its width?
Wow, there must not be a lot going on in the North Carolina Senate for them to have that kind of time on their hands.
It's fair to say that you don't have to do much trawling on social media or indeed digital networks to appreciate that actually many human beings tend to be unkind in terms of the things that they put out there. Well, maybe we need to address this. And indeed, with one in two people saying that they're going to be try to be kinder as we emerge out of the other side of the pandemic, then maybe we also need to say, well, actually, the glass is going to be half full. Let's talk through this with respect to research from the wonderful KIND organization. We've got psychologist, presenter, and social scientist. That's Anjula Mutanda with us. How are you, Anjula?
I'm well. How are you?
excellent. And we've also got the director at Kind, of course, Alexa Dalton. How are you, Alexa?
Great, Alex. It's great to be here.
Brilliant. Okay, Angela, if we can come to you first. I always like to think the best of people. I think we'd like to do that as a matter of course. But even though being kind to one another is something which has been rooted into our DNA for thousands of years, I mean, let's face it, you go back to Babylonian times, the Egyptians, you know, being kind, it's a fundamental aspect of human beings. There still seems to be this propensity to actually be mean, be unkind, and not follow that. Why is that?
I think that's what's so interesting about the research that the Kind Snacks did, is it illuminated that, yes, at the heart of it, human beings have the capacity for kindness. We need it. It's a pro-social behaviour. If we're all there individuating, being mean to each other, we wouldn't advance as a species. But I think what we also found is that, you know, over time, our hectic lives, circumstances, environmental factors can all make us a little less kind than we'd like to be. And what was so interesting about this research is that 4.1 million Brits said that they felt they were kind up until the age of about 10, and then it started to go away, which suggests to me that maybe life and circumstance, growing up, getting into teenage years, developmental stuff, all kind of gets in the way, and we forget about those small kindnesses, which are actually very bonding and connecting activities.
I mean, Alexa, from your own experience, is this something which you think we put on this hard edge as we actually sort of enter those teenage years? Life gives us knocks, it gives us lemons, and we just got to say, well, we can't make lemonade, it's all over.
Yeah, I mean, what the research said was that, you know, the majority of people were too busy or sometimes hangry, and that resulted in them being unkind. So very handy at Kind Snacks that we make nutritious and delicious snacks to help with the hunger. But really, it is that sort of life getting in the way of making those kind choices, which is why it's so refreshing to hear from kids about how we as adults can be more kind.
I mean, Angela, that tipping point that we hear about losing the objective to being kind. I mean, it may seem, you know, we're having a conversation today where we're basically being kind, we're being positive on that side of things, but actually embedding that into our root aspects of human beings, is it just a case of we need to almost get in touch with that inner child as well?
We do. And I think what was so brilliant when these podcasts with Katie Piper, who is a wonderful person to work alongside, but we had the most phenomenally brilliant children as our experts. And we gave them three different topics to talk about: mental health, politics, gender. And I was really actually interested in not only what they were saying, but how they were treating one another, because they had different perspectives. They were respectful, they were thoughtful, they were smiling at one another. It was just a positive, contagious environment to be in where people felt so good. And I think these are the things that we forget about as we get older and we get busier and we don't feel we have the time. We're stressed out by multiple factors. You know, just being in the teen years is tough enough. And I think we have to, as exactly as you say, get in touch with our inner 10-year-old, who is that authentic, pure self, who just wants to connect with other people and just get along before you get into that space where life can feel like a bit of a challenge. But the good news is just, you know, practicing small acts of kindness can make not only the receiver feel good, but also the person, you know, doing the act of kindness too. So it's a two-way street.
And is it very much that baby steps that need to be taken, that actually sort of you don't have to necessarily say, oh, I've got to actually be a philanthropic gesture on the lines of Bill Gates, etc. I need to actually sort of, you know, just actually give a certain amount of time, actually setting it aside to being kind will actually help.
Yes. And if you think about what a lot of people have gone through during lockdown, you know, a lot of people have bonded with their neighbours. They've done shopping for somebody who can't get out. They've sent a text to say, are you doing OK? You know, grandparents who normally would have stayed away perhaps from, you know, technology are on Zoom meeting their new grandchildren. That everybody's making that bit of an effort. And that's what kindness is. It's just making a little bit of an effort until it becomes habit, and you just then do it without thinking. So we just have to practice these small acts of kindness, which actually, as shown by the kids, come very naturally to us.
Alexa, returning to yourself once again, apart from the fact that your Christian name actually triggers off so many computer devices, it's just unbelievable, but it's fine. I'm sure you're used to that. It's all good. Yeah. I know I have a similar sort of experience myself. Kind within the sort of kind snack scenario, is this something which is rooted in, obviously, in the brand ethos and in terms of you, when you go into Kind, for instance, is it a case of, well, we're all kind to each other. It's there. It's emblazoned upon us.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it really is part of our everyday. So we're always thinking about, you know, how can we create products that are really delicious and also kind to people's bodies? But how are we behaving as an organization? What are the kind things that we do to look after our own mental health, those of our community? We volunteer every quarter. You know, we're really out there and being active as a business. And fundamentally, it's kind of why people come to work for us. So it is really important in our DNA as a business.
So, Angela, is it a case of we need to be kind to ourselves in order to be kind to others? Is that also a step forward?
That's also really important. That's something that, honestly, if you get a moment, listen to the podcast. These are all things that the kids come up with. A lot of the children were saying, you know, we want our parents to be kind to themselves because they work really hard. And I think that's a good point to remember, that being kind to yourself is an act of kindness. It actually is part of your mental and your physical and emotional well-being. And we want a healthier society all the way around, don't we? So it is about that. So be good to yourself and be good to others.
Absolutely. And pay it forward, presumably, Alexa. Actually, sort of that whole notion of it might just be a small act of kindness. Even if it's just a case of a small smile that you give out in the shop to somebody who sort of work on that basis, that can actually trigger off positive feelings that can really reverberate across the worlds of society.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just taking that moment of consideration and empathy for others. It's not a massive act that takes many hours or lots of money. It is the small things that actually make the biggest difference.
Well, it's been fantastic getting some general thoughts and insights into this. Angela, we've talked several times about the Kids Live Kind podcast. It's already launched. It's out there. Where can people actually access it from? Which platform should they go to?
You can find the Kids Live Kind on streaming services and mainly on Spotify. So if you go there, you can tune in and hear those wonderful kids tell you all about kindness.
And Alexa, obviously, Kind Snacks, they're out in all sorts of ways, shapes or forms. But is there any way in which people can actually follow up this survey and this research that was actually carried out in terms of how people are looking to channel more kindness into their everyday lives?
Yeah, so if you want more ideas, we recommend you go to kindsnacks.co.uk/livekind. Or also, we're of course on Instagram. So if you go to @kindsnacksuk, you can find out lots more ideas there.
Well, we'll wrap up with our traditional questions, which in an era where, as I always say to my students, be kind, we'll throw them at you both. First of all, Angela, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today?
Sorry, say that again.
Have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today? Has it been okay for you?
It's been a great day. Thank you.
You could have given us a sort of upside down smile and nose, dreadful, whatever. And Alexa, what about yourself?
Yeah, it's been brilliant. Thanks so much for your time.
So can we prevail upon you to maybe join us again in the not too distant future? Will you be kind enough to do that, ladies?
Absolutely.
What a lovely invite.
Well, it's that time of the year when, of course, we see the announcement, of course, of the Sotheby's Wine Encyclopedia. And we're delighted to actually welcome to the programme today sommelier extraordinaire and indeed editor of the new Sotheby's Wine Encyclopedia. And that's the fabulously talented Oshi Senkayeli. How are you, Oshi?
Hi, Alex. I'm great. And thank you very much for having me on the show.
Great to connect with your good self. Now, this is almost a dream job, isn't it, if you're into wines? I mean, actually having to discern the sort of key things there and producing the things.
It really is. I think I'm one of the very lucky ones who can do what they really love. And, you know, my job is my hobby too.
Which is all wonderful stuff. Now, this particular edition is particularly interesting because it's been updated for the first time since 2011. So there's been a bit of a gap there. A decade really has actually passed by. What are the kind of key highlights in terms of how the wines of the world have actually been evolving?
That's right. 10 years have passed. And what we see is the wine world is expanding at a huge rate. So the newcomers, if you can say that, are Asia, definitely. 10 years ago, China, for example, was nowhere to be seen in the wine scene. Today, they are a major player, and very soon, the consumers can also meet some of the products that they do. And also Western and Northern Europe. I mean, who would have thought such a success of the English wine industry at home and slowly but surely in the world. And coming up is Denmark, Sweden, and all around those Northern countries where we wouldn't have thought that great wine could ever come from. And due to climate change partly and the evolution of grape growing and winemaking techniques, now this is all a reality.
It does seem as though shortly only going to be the Antarctic that's going to be not a wine growing area. And I'm sure we could actually sort of artificially terraform that as well. Maybe we should actually go for wine on the moon. That's another sort of line to develop. 14,000 red, wine and rosé recommendations handpicked from more than 100 wine growing regions. Is this a task that takes a decade, or is this a case of you're constantly always looking to see what's happening? Well, you mentioned China, though. I mean, I think most people would have thought, well, maybe rice wine, perhaps, but different sort of brands from that perspective. So talk us through the kind of way and the procedures in which you put together the full Sotheby's Wine Encyclopedia.
Yes, so the book is wholly updated. We've been fortunate to work with National Geographic, who added the brand new maps, which is an entire profession in itself, and it's a huge work. And of course, Tom Stevenson's almost or over three decades of hard work of discovering producers and constantly updating all the information of the wine regions in the world is continued with the new regions added, and of course all the updated producer information and some bits and pieces that the reader can discover in the brand new encyclopedia.
And Tom, of course, three times Wine Writer of the Year award winner, so he pretty much knows what he's talking about, including putting together a troubleshooter's guide to potential wine faults. So, I mean, for somebody who's not necessarily by any means an expert in terms of wine, how does one actually say, oh, you know, that's corked, or that's problematic, or what's happened with this one?
I think if someone encounters a wine that definitely doesn't taste as it should, then that's when we would suspect a wine fault. It takes a little bit of training of the senses and the mind, but I can promise you, if an expert shows you a wine that is corked, you will never miss another corked wine again, because it has this musty wet cardboard aroma that is very, very easy to spot. But of course, you first have to find the wine that has these kinds of faults. And hopefully you won't.
yeah, that's very true. So, Oshie, what brought your own career to becoming editor of the Sotheby's Wine Encyclopedia? Was it something you'd always kind of passionately had a feeling for? I mean, or was it just a case of, well, I just fell in it one day?
Oh, this has been a long time dream of mine. I first met and read the Sotheby's Encyclopedia at its previous edition, and I read it cover to cover, and it has helped me so much with my wine studies. So when the opportunity came, I just jumped at it, and I feel the luckiest person alive to have been a contributor to this wonderful, wonderful work. I studied law. I'm specializing on protected origin of wine, and I've spent almost a decade working as a sommelier, so both the theoretical and practical side is close to me.
And do you have a particular favorite yourself, i.e. a favorite country or a favorite wine? Are there any particular areas where you think, yeah, ultimately I'd always go for, I don't know, a New Zealand, for instance?
I do have, well, which one is your favorite child? If there is just the one wine that that I had to choose and I'm absolutely pressed, I think it would be champagne. I love sparkling wines and I find them a fascinating category in itself. And of course, champagne is such a classic classic example that I would choose. New Zealand, fantastic, lovely, lovely wines with increasing diversity. So New Zealand, for example, is not anymore just about Sauvignon Blanc. They've got beautiful, beautiful Pinot Noirs, lovely sparkling wines. And just in general, to see how a country's wine world is evolving is really exciting. And, you know, back to the UK, this has been just born in front of our eyes. It's fantastic to see how the quality is constantly improving and how people are starting to really appreciate
the joys of wine. I mean, people are already phoning up to actually sort of say, "Oh, she, we need to move on. It's fantastic." Listen, finally, how do people get hold of the Sotheby's Wine Encyclopedia? Where's the best place that they can actually go to find out more details?
It is available in the larger wine shops and also the very, very large online retailer that we tend to buy too many things these days.
Oshi, it's been lovely speaking to you today and getting a general flavor. Let's hope it's not 10 years before we actually speak again. So that's all good from that point of view, because there's a whole range of things there. For the moment, though, Oshi Saint-Kyrie, is that a reasonable attempt at the pronunciation?
Saint-Kyrie.
Saint-Kyrie. Okay, Oshi Saint-Kyrie, huge thanks. Take care and happy wine tasting.
Thank you, Alex.